Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I'm joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very special episode with a very special guest. Today, we are going to be talking about the updated nutrition guidelines in the U.S., and we thought, who better to do that with us than a world-renowned dietitian? So we have Susan Wiener with us. We're very excited to have her. And Susan, if you don't mind just introducing yourself and giving a little bit of your background for our listeners and viewers.
Of course, I'm so excited to be here to have this discussion with you guys today. My name is Susan Wiener. I'm a registered dietitian and certified diabetes care and education specialist in private practice in New York. And so happy to get into this discussion.
Awesome. Well, this has been really big news. The nutrition guidelines are definitely very different than before. So if you guys haven't seen it, it's basically an upside down pyramid. And there's some pretty big changes at the top, big emphasis on animal products, more protein, meat, dairy sources, and still fruits and vegetables and still everything else. It's just things have been rearranged a little bit. So Susan, we'd love to hear a little bit like the historical perspective. Like how often are these guidelines updated? Like what did it look like before this new pyramid came out?
Of course. So the Dietary Guidelines for Americans come out every 5 years. But I think it's really important to point out that the food pyramid was from 1992, had one revamp, and then has not been used since 2011 when we came up with the MyPlate method, right? So the MyPlate method is actually a plate, and on the plate, it portioned into half the plate as whole grains and the other half of the plate as protein and fruits and vegetables and dairy on the side and water. So it was simple. And could it be upgraded, updated? Absolutely. So we haven't used the pyramid in about 15 years. So it's funny to hear that, oh, there's a new pyramid in town. So it's replacing really my plate, not the pyramid that hasn't been used since 2011. So that's the first part of it. And so the dietary guidelines came out, and they're based on scientific review of a lot of data that comes out from the dietary advisory committee on these guidelines. And that report came out from nutrition experts and was over 140 pages. What we're seeing in this upside down pyramid that you described comes along with a 10-page narrative. So some of the recommendations that come and citations from that very long report did not all translate into the new guidelines. And some of the information that's coming in with the new guidelines that and the pyramid are good. I love the fact that we are emphasizing eating more whole foods. I really like that. I like cutting back on sugar. But some of the guidelines that we're going to talk about today can be very confusing. So I'd love to get into that.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, something they emphasize throughout is like, this is more common sense, like try to avoid processed foods and have natural foods like whole grains, fruits, vegetables, kind of dairy products that are not processed. And actually, there was some image in one of these documents I was looking at that compared different dairy products to different yogurts. And one was like your just regular, like whole fat yogurt, like wasn't processed. And then compared it to like a low fat yogurt where they took out some of the fat, but then added a bunch of sugar, and then compared that to a fat free where they took out more fat and then added kind of other ingredients and processed types of ingredients along with sugar. So that I feel like that is like that does make a lot of sense. I think we were led for a long time on fat is really bad. We should try to get rid of fat. It's too many calories, and switch to these other versions, which maybe actually weren't so healthy for us.
It's a really great point. So let's look at a comparison, though. The lower saturated fat from the previous guidelines were less than 10% of total calories. The new guidelines for saturated fat are, drumroll, less than 10% of total calories. So that didn't change. What's confusing is when we go to full fat, and much to your point, there are a lot of benefits, a lot of research, a lot of studies that do show some of the benefits of doing that. However, the recommendations also state that they're recommending 3 servings of full fat dairy per day, which of course also doesn't apply to people who are vegan, right? Or people with lactose allergy, or people who culturally don't eat or tolerate dairy. That's an issue. But if you had an 8-ounce glass of whole milk, that's 4.5 to 5 grams of saturated fat. Mm-hmm. So 3 servings of that, plus, let's say, 1 tablespoon or 2 of butter, each of which have 5 grams of saturated fat. If you're looking at a 2,000-calorie diet, which would be a maximum of 22 grams of total saturated fat a day, you're already up there from your recommended dairy servings, plus the butter that might be recommended in this. So the individualization and the need to understand this for individuals is still a little bit murky.
Interesting. So what you're saying is basically if you follow the guidelines, you're going to be way over your fat content. So you can't follow the guidelines and follow the guidelines because it just doesn't, it's not quite matching up.
Exactly. So some of it doesn't match up unless you eat less of that amount to fit into that less than 10%. That's a little bit of an issue. The second thing that was a little bit of a red flag for me was some of the things that were omitted. So the new guidelines are saying have no or very limited added sugars, which is actually a good recommendation to cut down on the amount of added sugars in the diet. They're also saying to have no added sugar for children under 10 years of age. And it previously was for no added sugar for children under 2 years of age. And that's going to be a difficult guideline to follow for many people who have children, right? So that's kind of a difficult guideline, but that's a recommendation. We're also looking at reducing the recommendation to reduce ultra-processed, or they call it highly processed foods. And we get that. And that also makes sense. But what's not listed is highly processed meats. So are they also saying to reduce the intake of highly processed meats, such as bacon or sausage or cold cuts that might be in that area? So that can be confusing for people. And as a registered dietitian, I would say if you're a person who's living with a chronic disease, a person living with diabetes, cardiovascular disease, I hope that you're taking advantage of medical nutrition therapy and working with your registered dietitian with all of this information coming out.
Yeah, I feel like it's very, like, I'm a pretty well-educated person and I'm kind of left with like, okay, well, what am I supposed to eat now? I think a lot of work is going to need to be done to translate this to like the everyday person and what this looks like and what are healthy foods. And also, it's one thing to just say, okay, well, we should try to limit processed foods. But I think there's still a lot of confusion on, well, what is really processed? Like, and I don't think it's realistic to say we're not going to ever have a processed food. And also labeling. I mean, labeling is still pretty murky, where you've got labeling on a food that says it sounds to be very healthy, but it's not. And an example is these bars. Like, I've been eating granola bars and protein bars and bars for years, right? All different kinds of bars, probably many times thinking I'm being so healthy and I'm eating an energy bar and a protein bar, and they're all processed. But it's confusing. It's just the labeling is confusing. The labeling really like leads the everyday consumer to kind of think, well, this seems like a healthy choice.
Food labeling is extremely confusing. And that was not addressed here, but certainly that is an extremely big concern for everybody, and very catchy, and colors and what's good and what's not. And part of the guidelines in the 10-page narrative that again accompanies the visual graphic is to also reduce or eliminate most non-nutritive sweeteners. So in those bars, if you're going to not have added sugar, which is a big recommendation, are you also not having a lot of the non-nutritive sweeteners? So if it's something that has protein in it and fat in it, and by taste, we talked about the yogurt and things like that, something has to make it taste okay, or we have to get used to things tasting a different way. And part of the nutrition and the food experience is enjoying what you're eating. And I'm all about, part of what I do is exposing people to different tastes and spices and seasonings, which they do recommend. I did like that too in the 10-page narrative. Something that confused me a little bit, though, is the sodium recommendations are the same, under 2,300 milligrams a day on both. But in the 10-page narrative, it will say, season your food with seasonings and herbs and add salt if you need to. But then underneath that, it's going to say, maybe limit your salt. So it's a little, again, it needs some clarification. I wanted to also bring up, and I know that you guys will probably ask about this, but this really stood out to me, alcohol. So in the previous guidelines, it said limit alcohol intake to less than 2 drinks a day for men, and describe that what that was, and less than 1 drink a day per women, of course, not if you are breastfeeding, lactating, if you have an alcohol issue, or if there are other conditions, of course. And they put in citations and links with the problems with alcohol, that it can be related to cancer and other issues. In the new guidance, it basically says drink less, does not give you that drink less than 2 drinks a day or 1 drink per day. And there's no links to what it may cause with other health problems. So drink less. And it also says not if you're pregnant and not if you have an issue with alcohol use. However, I felt that more specific guidance there is absolutely warranted.
I absolutely agree, because I could say, well, drink less. I drink 3 a day. I weigh 112 pounds. So 2 a day is probably still not good for me, as an example, right? Never mind. Exactly. Like that drink less, you know, at 1 a day for women does not mean 6 on Friday, right? It is, exactly. It is not all adding it up, right? So some of that is we need specific guidelines for people who would say, well, I can justify this or move this. You know, it'll be interesting to see how that is taken and how in and out of context, right? I mean, again, when we deal with people with alcohol-induced diabetes, when we deal with people who are drinking on top of diabetes, and we can see the effect of alcohol just on the glucose, never mind on the liver and all these other organ systems, it does concern me that it's almost like it's been loosened, right? Like it's just a little bit less. The guidance isn't as tight. And I felt like that tight guidance was actually helping us, because I could quote that guidance in my notes.
Absolutely. So the information that came out of these, that was absolutely on point, on target. The information from the dietary guideline is also used to set policy. So what it's showing in these guidelines is going to be taught to children in school. These are the dietary guidelines. Let's learn about nutrition. But it also can define what's served at school lunches, right?
Yes. In terms of policy. Great thing, right? Like this allows us to change. Right. Yes.
Yes. Might affect, I don't know this specifically, but I'm assuming because it's policy, would it also affect what's served in the military? Will it affect WIC and SNAP benefits? So this is going to affect a lot of these things. And getting back to the alcohol, that specific guidance, I'm very interested to see if that will affect other medical professionals who may look and say, oh, the guidance has been loosened. And of course, we all use our individual clinical senses, but we have to be very careful in making sure that people understand what alcohol is and what it does. And also, the previous guidance showed what a drink was, 5 ounces of wine or 1 ounce of spirits, whatever that meant. We're not describing what a pour is here, right? So it's very confusing.
I have a question about like professional organizations and how they adopt these guidelines, because I couldn't help but notice the American Heart Association on their social media right after these guidelines came out was showing a plate, was showing the plate method still. And so I guess my question is, how do these professional organizations adopt or not adopt these guidelines? Historically, have they adopted them? Or may we see that some continue to, for example, say, well, one alcoholic drink for women, two for men, and kind of differ a little bit in these guidelines?
I saw the same things come out from the AHA, very, very interesting. And what they're saying is let's take that one piece at a time. If you look at the fat recommendations, and now for the first time, the fat recommendations include olive oil, but they also include butter and beef tallow, right? So the American Heart Association is saying, and they're not differentiating at all between full fat meat and leaner meats. So the American Heart Association is coming out with still, like the plate method, leaner cuts of meats. And if you do want to do healthy fats, they should be fats that are not as high in saturated fat. So they're doing those guidelines. I think it will be very interesting to see, and I think that they will, that the cancer associations, the heart associations, and the medical association is going to call out which is why I called it out, the alcohol specifications, because it is linked to disease states, possibly mental health, and other areas of health. And we had seen during COVID and back a few years ago an increased uptick at food costs of people with drinking more alcohol. So having some guidance and how that might be linked to everything, including caloric intake, has to be looked at. I'd be shocked if we don't hear more from different organizations on the alcohol piece. I haven't seen anything specifically yet, but I have from people from organizations who are speaking out on boards and things like that, just their own two cents about it. But I think you can't not have that. And there are quarantine recommendations, right?
Right. I can see for certain organizations like the American Diabetes Association saying, hey, for people with diabetes, we still recommend these limits. So something I, you know, as I was perusing all of the materials, I noticed that there are these appendices that are, I think, are about 420 pages long. But I noticed there's actually one image in here I particularly really like about highly processed foods and their associated risk. And it goes through kind of some different things like all-cause mortality, cancer, liver diseases, type 2 diabetes, and the association, which I think is actually a really powerful visual. But one question I had for you is they go through kind of the evidence for so many different things, but they talk about this linoleic acid. And I guess, you know, maybe it's one of the bad guys with the fat. I don't know. But I'm really curious, like, if you can translate that for us and kind of where that comes from and what we should be looking or watching out for with fats.
So confusing, as is some of this information. So we look at essential fatty acids. And I always think the best way to get more essential fatty acids is to have more fish, omega-3s, get them through things like nuts and seeds and eat them through these type of foods. I mean, we'll get to fiber because I think that that's something that's also got lost in a lot of this discussion as well. But that is linolenic and oleic acid, part of the essential fatty acids. Those are richer in some of the seed oils, which some of the recommendations, not specifically called out, we have to show that in the final report of the dietary guidelines, which is what we are seeing here with what the public is really looking at here. So those are not really being promoted. What I would say is when we're eating fats from these sources, like I said, with more fatty fish and with nuts and with seeds and ways to get fat like that, you're getting all the avocados. You're getting a lot of the good fats without some of the bad things that come along with them. I would say that the processed and highly processed foods, which again, I'm glad that that was a big song at the beginning to avoid them, that are in a lot of the frozen products, prepackaged products we have, which we're trying to get rid of. And that's a really good thing with these guidelines. Those foods contain a lot of these fats that we want to avoid. I would caution against, like, if you're cutting back now with some of the good parts of this guidance of eating prepackaged foods and a lot of candy and chips and cookies and things like that, not eating too much of that, you're not going to get a lot of these fats. If you eat more of the whole foods, you don't have to really worry about that. Going back to the point of label reading, the fewer ingredients on a label, generally the better it is, which is why eating more whole foods, more fish, more chicken, more fruits and vegetables, more whole foods is the way to avoid things that might be linked, like you're saying, to chronic disease development, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. The other good call out in the general discussion of this is they did call out the gut microbiome in the 10-page document and to eat more fermented foods like sauerkraut and kefir, I think were two of the foods that they mentioned that people might not be familiar with. But what's not called out is to make sure that people are also getting enough fiber in the diet. And so I just want to make sure that we are eating enough fruits and vegetables to be able to get fiber from those sources.
That's a really good point. Because, yeah,
I think we talk about fiber a lot, you know, I mean, and, you know, because Diana and I see patients every day and we use GLP-1s and some of them end up, some of the people that take a GLP-1 end up with constipation issues, right? So we talk a lot about adding fiber for those kinds of things. We talk about adding fiber for people to help make them feel fuller longer. We talk about fiber for just overall gut health. And, you know, getting enough fiber throughout the day really does mean you're adding fruit and vegetables to every meal and snack, right? Really to get those in. And so I am a little, I was a little startled that there isn't, like, there's always been that you need 40 or 60 or whatever the number is based on your height, weight, exercise level, whether you have GI issues or not. It's not as robust here. You know,
it's not as robust is the right word. Not at all. So if you're getting 50 to 100% more protein than was recommended before, when we go from 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, so where does that convert to my math? 0.55 to 0.72 grams per pound, something like that. That's how it converts. Because it's so funny to me that it's listed in kilograms, but nobody understands what that means when they're reading these guidelines as the general public. So I always bring that up. So if you're eating, they're recommending eating this at every meal. And most of the recommendations are towards meat. The picture shows a big ribeye steak and meat, right? And it does show a piece of salmon, I think, on there. But we're not seeing in terms of the mention is there to eat more plant foods as well, but it's a smaller mention. So if you're eating full-fat dairy and you're eating these higher protein foods, it's harder when, very hard, when you're on a GLP-1 to then get in those whole grains or beans or seeds or nuts or other things with fiber and not exceed any kind of, forget calorie limit because we're not even looking at calories at this point, but we're looking at the overall nutrition piece. But it's hard to get there if you almost have, you only have so much space to eat what you're eating. So it really, some of the translation of this is very confusing. And when I work with many patients who are on GLP-1s also, and with this new guidance, I am sticking with my own Susan plate method of including, of course, the whole foods as we do, and some of the guidance of that's coming out. But definitely, I don't think that it's that much different with those of us who have been preaching reducing added sugars and eating more whole foods. But the fiber part is really lost a little bit. I don't remember which of my colleagues did this, but it was hilarious. They redesigned the pyramid. They kept the pyramid, but they put beans like all over.
I saw that.
Did you? I can't remember who did it now, but it was perfect.
I saw that on, I think on LinkedIn. Yeah, I was like, they're like, where are the beans?
Where are the beans?
But that was actually going to be one of my questions for you. So yeah, I mean, this is a pretty, I think a big difference, the protein amount. I believe before it was like 0.8 grams per kilogram, and now it's 1.2 to 1.6.
100% more. It's from 0.8.
Right, right.
But my question is,
are people already eating this? Like, are people getting enough protein?
That's what I said. Right, they're already getting it. We're already getting too much protein. But now I think it's going to lead people to eat even more protein. And is it really needed? I mean, is that, to me, I'd much rather someone eat more vegetables and even a whole fruit than eating more and more protein, especially if we're leaning towards, you know, it says lean protein, but are people, lots of people can't afford lean proteins right now. So Susan, can you talk a little bit about any of that?
Yeah, they're not even promoting lean protein. The older guidelines were lean protein. This is just protein. And to Diana's point from before, people are going to pick up a protein bar and go, there's protein in that. It looks great and it works because I'm seeing all these patients today. How am I going to eat this, you know, in between? But it has added sugars or non-nutritive sweeteners all through it. So it doesn't really work. Okay. People who are not resource poor and people, most people who are not resource poor, but they, many people, I should say, also have other conditions or other thoughts on it. You are absolutely right. Eat an adequate amount of protein overall. People who don't have access to adequate protein, live in food deserts, or may not tolerate it or can't afford it for whatever reasons, I think could also be put off by seeing a ribeye steak and a big, nice piece of salmon right there at the top because it's not going into what they're actually seeing. So that's a really more challenging, difficult problem. But yes, to your point, many people do eat enough protein, which is good. It probably, based on some of the research, it could be more than 0.8 on the guidance. But should it be 1.6? That's a lot of protein. And that's a lot of protein that we're saying to have. And maybe, and I think that this was something that the American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics also came out with. That might be at the expense of other nutrients if people are seeing this and just going for the protein. And if they're eating enough protein and now they're told to eat more, then where are the fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, beans going to fit in at all? Or things with fiber fit in at all? So the refined carbohydrates, which they're saying to eliminate, are things where food's been refined and processing and part of the germ and the bran have been taken out so that it doesn't have as much nutrition and as much vitamins. So they're saying to avoid things like white bread or white crackers or things that that have less nutrition. The word avoid is a challenging word for many people who only have access to certain foods.
Yeah, I mean, right. We try to avoid the word avoid. I do have a question because I guess what surprised me is I'm seeing so much evidence for plant-based eating. Yeah. And also I hear about some of the environmental issues with animal products. Can you speak a little bit about like those concerns from people?
That's not being addressed at all in these guidelines. The people who are, or the excellent articles I've read from people discussing it. So again, I'm taking this from other things that I've read, is that eating many more animal products, for example, animal protein, animal products will make that worse, make emissions worse. It's worse for the environment and things of that nature. I'm not an expert in that area, but it kind of makes sense that if we go like completely in the direction of eating 50 to 100% more on the recommendation of protein and primarily animal protein and full fat dairy products as well, that has to affect some of the environment. And don't forget what I said before, this is going to affect policy. This affects policy. That's by design. These dietary guidelines affect benefits, again, WIC, SNAC, SNAP, school lunch programs. So these, if these guidelines are followed, or military benefits of food. So these are things that will be incorporated into those programs. I can't imagine that that's going to be right across the board and won't have some kind of cost on something, just cost alone. So it's interesting. And of course, looking at some of the good things that came out of these guidelines, again, that we've discussed, there, it's not all good and bad, but some of the nuances are very confusing and has to have other ramifications.
Right. It sounds like, yeah, there's just going to be a lot of effort to translate this to the everyday person and figure out, yeah, how to come up. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I have to say, like, as I look at this new pyramid, I'm like, well, McDonald's sounds like it could be healthy because I could take the hamburger and not have the bun. And then I guess depending on how the fries, if it's just cut up potatoes, and I guess depending what oil it's cooked with, like, I don't know. Like, so the everyday person, I could just see thinking they're making like a really healthy choice and kind of misinterpreting things. Yeah.
So the interpretation there would be, and it's so funny, when I was first a dietitian back, one of the big things about McDonald's was that they took out making their French fries in beef tallow. And now it's one of the things that are listed. It's so funny you brought that up. On the dietary guidelines for Americans. So that's just weird to me. What they would argue with what you're saying about the McDonald's is that that hamburger is an overly processed, that's not natural, coming from like right from the meat hamburger. There are other things that are in just the hamburger, like if you had it off the bun, because that's refined carbohydrate, right? So that wouldn't work in that circumstance. But your thought process of somebody doing that, because I don't think McDonald's even has salads on the menu anymore, right? So
that's what I heard, yeah.
I don't know. So, I mean, so I'm not really sure how that would be interpreted. The other thing that's suggested through the 10-page narrative and through a lot of this discussion is to cook more at home, eat more home-cooked meals. And I think that that's such a great suggestion. Yeah. It's such a great suggestion. It just doesn't always happen. It doesn't always happen. And if you're cooking, this is from my perspective, again, being a dietitian a really long time, for people who cook home a lot, what we want is a break sometimes to eat out. So if you're eating out, the suggestion is make good choices when you eat out. And the natural thought process is, if I'm eating out, I'm not eating what I'm eating at home. I'm having something different when I eat out.
Right. I'm not getting a grilled chicken breast if I make that at home. I'm going to get something special that I wouldn't. And isn't that okay if I'm only eating out once in a while? Again, there's not eat better. I also, you know, eat better is not enough for most people. They don't know what better is, right? So they don't know that the meat, and can they afford, you know, can you afford ground meat that is just ground meat? Can you afford hamburger that is truly just hamburger or turkey or whatever you're getting ground, right? There's a lot of inequity questions, I think, that have come from this. And I think that's I think there's going to be a lot of discussion over the next handful of weeks, months, and year as to where this goes and what, and watching and seeing how policy, how things change, what looks like life at school, you know, things. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is only, and we're having such a fantastic, robust discussion here. I think this is the tip of the iceberg. Because in that very detailed report that came from the Dietary Guidelines Scientific Committee, that was much longer than the, and much more deeply cited than the 10-page narrative that came out with the inverted pyramid. I think that that's going to, people are going to look at that over time and say, why was this not included? And why was this recommendation not included? And that's where we're going to hear more. from the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the American Medical Associations, cancer associations. I think that that's more going to be pulling in, especially with the alcohol, probably with the protein. I know that I heard from a colleague of mine who works in nephrology and nutrition that this amount of protein is disturbing to her for some of her clients, and certainly with the development of kidney stones for people who are prone to it. So there are specific elements that will have to be called out. And the translation and nuances to the general public, we need to do a little better on.
And just before we close out, can you just clarify, because that long document with all the evidence and the citations, that was actually a different group than the group that wrote kind of this 10-page, like it was a different committee, right?
Right, right.
Okay.
So that's a different committee. That's a, and I don't know the exact name, but that's a scientific advisory committee. And I believe all volunteer positions that put it, they review all the research and put all that in. I do not know if anyone from that committee was on the final committee that published the final document, but that is a different committee that comes up and does all the research, all these experts in different areas and different fields related to nutrition. They come up with that documentation, review all the data, the scientific evidence, the research, the studies, put together all that data for the committee to come up with the final version of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans.
Yeah, I think that's an important clarification because I initially looked at that and I assumed it was the same group. And I was like, wow, this is a really, really impressive document that's citing all this research and the research gaps. But it turns out it is different groups that kind of ultimately came out with the guidance. So I think that's important.
Yes, and I took, and obviously some of it came out of that because some of the things are very similar to the previous guidance, like the less than 10% of saturated fat. But things like that were pulled out in there, such as the alcohol and other things, are different. And there might have been, I haven't peeled through that document in full detail, there might have been some newer research or things that say we need further studies. Another one, and we've talked about this, but you could see there was different, like it was no added sugar in the previous guidance for children 2 years and less, and now it's 10 years. So there's things that I guess were changed along the way.
Yeah. Well, this has been an incredible discussion. I'm Susan, we can't thank you enough because you've really like made this conversation so rich and really offered your expertise to explain all of this. So we thank you so much. And with that, we thank everyone for tuning in. That wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.